Welcome back. In the following three lectures, we're going to be examining the impact of Hellenism on Roman literature. I'm going to begin with epic, first because it's the oldest surviving literary genre, second because it had a higher status than any other genre, and third because some of the greatest works in both Latin and Greek are epics, and fourth because the genre underwent a complete transformation when it was adopted by the Romans, though it remained essentially true to its Greek roots in purely formal ways. And when I say it's the oldest surviving literary genre, I don't just mean in terms of Greek literature, but in terms of Mediterranean culture. I'm thinking of the so-called Epic of Gilgamesh, the first evidence for which dates to the early 2nd millennium BC. Our word epic comes from the Greek epos, which in the plural, epeia, means epic poetry. And when we use epic today as a noun, it's usually prefaced by the word Hollywood. And when we use it as an adjective, it's often followed by the word struggle or challenge or the like. In antiquity, however, it's only used of literature. I'm going to concentrate primarily on Virgil's Aeneid and on the Greek epics from which it drew, notably Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, though I'll have something as well to say later about Roman epics. I've chosen the Aeneid because it's not only one of the most spectacular achievements of Greco-Roman culture in any artistic medium, but because it also happens to provide us with the most candid expression of Roman identity that has come down to us in any literary genre. We know nothing definite about Homer, not even whether he was blind, as it's always suggested. We don't actually know whether he was a single person, or whether Homer was the name for the many singers who composed oral epic around 700 BC. To begin with, I'll identify 10 characteristics regarding both the form and the subject matter of the epics we're discussing. Number one, an epic is a very lengthy narrative poem. It's several thousand lines in length. The Iliad, for instance, is over 15,000 lines long. The Odyssey, over 12,000 lines. And the Aeneid, some 10,000 lines long. Length is important because it enables the working through of a grand theme over a period of time. Number two, epic is written in a meter known as the dactylic hexameter. The dactyl is a metrical unit consisting of a long syllable followed by two short syllables, long, short, short. In the hexameter line, there are six dactyls. Now that would get awfully monotonous were it not for the fact that the two shorts could be resolved into a long syllable, so that instead of long, short, short, you get the option of long, long. And this meant that there could be all manner of variations between one line and the next for poetic or dramatic effect. There was also a system of stresses which introduced further variations. The opening line of the Iliad runs as follows: "Sing, goddess, of the wrath of Achilles, the son of Peleus." Meni naede thea, peleia dio Achilleos. Dactyl, dactyl, spondy, dactyl, dactyl, spondy. And the opening line of the Aeneid runs thus: "I sing of arms and the man who was the first to arrive from the shores of Troy. Arma virumque cano, Troiae qui primus aboris." Dactyl, dactyl, spondy, spondy, dactyl, spondy. It's an incredibly stately line, and it was an incredible achievement of the Romans to adapt it to their language. Number three, epic adopts a self-consciously elevated style. It's difficult to define exactly what this boils down to, but because the subject is serious, the diction has to be serious too. There are no colloquialisms, for instance, and the language is inherently serious. Epic number four uses an abundance of similes. Similes are a way for the poet to say, "I don't know how to put what I'm about to tell you in words that will make it easy for you to understand. So let me compare it to something you do know well. Similes often extend the scope of the action into the natural world, as when Virgil likens the workers who are building the new city of Carthage to bees. And as such, similes make the poem more universal. Number five, epic incorporates elaborate speeches. There are relatively few exchanges of brief dialogue. Number six, the theme is truly epic in scale and intensity. It's about great events, great men, great achievements, and sometimes as well great mistakes. Number seven, there's usually a journey that is undertaken by the hero, the central figure in the story. Odysseus has to get home to Ithaca. Aeneas has to find a new homeland. And number eight, the hero has to make discoveries about himself and about the world around him, discoveries that can be very painful. So he goes on an internal journey as well as an external journey. Achilles learns that sticking by your ideals without compromising may carry a very heavy price tag with it. In his case, the life of Patroclus, his dearest friend. Number nine, the gods play a major part in the action. They don't actually run the entire show, but they are interested in the final outcome, and they repeatedly, if somewhat sporadically, assist or hinder the hero in his objectives. And number 10, epic says something profound about man's place in the universe, about his relationship with the gods, and about human frailty and ignorance, about human courage and determination. And in so doing, it raises difficult questions about the value and purpose of heroism. Greek epic probably originated as hymns to the gods. Even by the time of Homer, or the group of singers who go under that name, the genre had been in existence in the Greek world for a very long time. Homer's subject was the Trojan War. His earlier work is the Iliad, which means the poem about Ilion, the Greek word for Troy. It covers a period of about 10 days in the 10th and final year of the Trojan War. The Odyssey, or poem about Odysseus, was written a generation later. It describes the return of Odysseus at the end of the Trojan War. Other epic poets, known as the cyclic poets, also treated the Trojan War, but only fragments of their work have survived. The reason their work hasn't survived is because Homer was too good. He effectively killed off all the competition, which means that nobody bothered to transmit their poems to future generations. The other epic poet whose work has survived from Homer's period is Hesiod. His major works are the Theogony and the Works and Days. The subject of his poetry, how the Olympian gods came to power, the Theogony, and how a peasant farmer should structure his year, works and days, didn't hold much appeal to the Romans, and so his influence was minimal. Though epic lost its dominance in the Greek world as literacy gained sway, Homer's popularity remained undiminished. In fact, Homer leads the field in the number of literary papyri found in Egypt. Papyri, that is, containing scraps of his poetry. Only Egypt, because of its hot sands, has left us this kind of evidence from antiquity. After Homer, there's a gap of 400 years before the next surviving epic, a highly sophisticated poem entitled The Argonautica by Apollonius of Rhodes, who was writing in Hellenistic Alexandria. Its subject was the quest of Jason and the Argonauts for the Golden Fleece. The Argonautica greatly influenced Virgil, notably in the portrayal of the passionate sorceress Medea, who provided the model for the equally passionate Dido, Queen of Carthage. Roman epic was greatly indebted to Greek models right from the word go. It began with a translation of Homer's Odyssey into Latin by Livius Andronicus, circa 280 to 205 BC, who you'll recall came to Rome as a slave, where he taught before earning his freedom and turning his talent to literature. Only a few fragments of his poem have survived. It was written in the 6-foot iambic, the so-called Saturnian meter. The Saturnian meter is shorter than the hexameter meter because an iam is a metrical unit that comprises just a short and a long syllable. Livius's slightly younger contemporary, Gnaeus Naevius, roughly 270 to 201, wrote an original historical Roman epic called Bellum Punicum, or The Punic War, in 7 books. Its subject was the conflict between Roman Carthage from 264 to 241, and it influenced Virgil in a number of ways. Naevius in particular gave prominence to Aeneas, whose story he told in the form of an extended digression. A generation later, Quintus Ennius wrote a poem, finished around 180 BC, called the Annales, or Annals. Ennius is a fascinating individual. He's not a Roman, at least not by birth, he's a Messapian. The Messapians were an Italian people who inhabited the heel of Italy. They served largely as auxiliaries in the Roman army. And it was through service in the Roman army that Ennius became acquainted with Cato the Elder, our celebrated Hellenophobe. Like Livius Andronicus, Ennius was a teacher. And like Livius, he wrote plays. And he also wrote in a number of other genres. So there's a sort of career path emerging here. Immigrant from southern Italy, familiar with Greek literature, comes to Rome, teaches, and eventually makes a name for himself in the world of letters. Ennius's Annales was in 18 books and comprised some 20,000 lines, but only about 600 survive. Enough, however, to indicate that he was a very considerable poet. In fact, he's credited with achieving the separation of colloquial Latin from literary Latin. Virgil was steeped in his poetry, and if the Annales had survived, we'd probably discover as many echoes of it in the Aeneid as we do of the Iliad and the Odyssey. His poem covered the whole of Rome's history from the fall of Troy down to his own day. In the last 2 centuries of the Republic, it became central to a Roman education, in much the same way that the works of Homer were central to the education of a Greek. As Horace tells us, he was alter Homeros, another Homer. In fact, Ennius himself claimed to be the reincarnation of Homer. Well, now that's going a bit far, and if he were alive today, we'd probably regard this as a shameless ploy to grab media attention. What's important for us, however, is, first, that Ennius saw himself in direct poetical descent from Homer. Second, that his claim to be the living embodiment of his great poetic predecessor is evidence of how high Homer's reputation was in Roman literary circles in the 2nd century BC. Ennius was, in fact, the first to abandon the Saturnian meter and to put Latin into hexameter. Just listen to it. Quis potis ingentis orase volvere belli? Who can unroll this great war from end to end? There's a sort of cragginess, even an awkwardness to his verses, but it's extremely powerful nonetheless. One might almost say that the awkwardness contributes to its monumentality, as if Ennius is trying to shift around very large boulders that haven't yet been cut into neat ashlar blocks. There are other reasons why we should salute Ennius as an innovator. It was he who adapted the genre into a useful vehicle for the expression of national sentiment. Homer had focused on individual acts of heroism and on an individual's quest for self-realization. Ennius, however, focused upon Romanitas, Rome's traditional values and her military achievements. The Iliad, by contrast, is not in the least nationalistic in that it views the Trojan War as much from the perspective of the Trojans as it does from that of the Greeks. It's very sympathetic, in fact, to the Trojans. And since Ennius played a major part in the education of Roman citizens, it's fair to say that he influenced how Romans looked back at their past and how they thought of themselves as a nation. His poem maintained its place in the curriculum for a century and a half and was ultimately replaced by the Aeneid, which Virgil composed at the request of the Emperor Augustus and which he left unfinished on his death in 19 BC. I don't mean that he didn't get to the last line, so to speak, though the poem does end somewhat abruptly, but rather that he intended to make revisions to what he had already written. He was reportedly so unsatisfied with it that he requested on his deathbed that it be burnt. Augustus was probably hoping for a poem that would glorify his achievements, culminating in his victory at the Battle of Actium. Instead, he got something far greater. Virgil borrowed heavily from Ennius, adapting and incorporating several of his lines. For instance, his line, et mecin gentis, oras e volviti belli, in the Aeneid, imitates the line of Ennius I quoted a moment ago, quis potis ingentis, oras e volviti belli. The debt that we can detect most easily, however, was to Homer, both to the Iliad and to the Odyssey. The opening words of the poem, arma virumque cano, I sing of arms and the man, actually evoke both poems, since the Iliad is about war and its devastating consequences, whereas the Odyssey is about the wanderings of one man on his way home from war. What Virgil does is to incorporate the theme of both epics into his poem, though he does so by reversing the Homeric order, as ancient critics were the first to point out. Books 1 through 6, the Odyssean half, describe Aeneas's search for a new home following the destruction of Troy, whereas books 7 through 12, the Iliadic half, describe the war that ensues in Italy when Aeneas eventually arrives in his destined homeland. The poem is, in fact, a completion of the Iliad, seen from the perspective of the Trojans. Virgil takes over many episodes from Homer, including descriptions of funeral games, the hero's visit to Hades, and the forging of his divine armor by Hephaestus Vulcan. But what's really fascinating about the Aeneid for our purposes is what's entirely Roman and un-Greek, since the poem is anything but a revival of a Greek legend in Roman drag. In fact, the Aeneid, perhaps more than any other literary work, demonstrates how differently the Romans conceived of their place in the universe and how differently they saw the world. Let me explain that. First, the poem is infused with what were the quintessential Roman values, fides and pietas. Fides is fidelity, faithfulness, sticking by an idea and seeing it through. Pietas translates as piety, a rather stuffy concept in today's world. What it means in Roman terms is doing the right thing for one's parents, one's country, the dead, and for the gods. Aeneas epitomizes piety in this Roman sense. Sum pius Aeneas, he says, when he first introduces himself to Dido, on whose shores he has been shipwrecked. What an opening line to deliver to a girl. One of the most memorable images which Virgil evokes is that of Aeneas fleeing from the ruins of Troy with his father Anchises on his back, hand in hand with his little son Ascanius. Anchises is grasping an image of the Penates, the household gods, which they take with them so that they can start a new home elsewhere. And all this is distinctly Roman because only a community with a strong sense of duty could have dedicated itself to the public good in the way the Romans did. The Aeneid is therefore an intensely moral poem. By contrast, neither the Iliad nor the Odyssey is in the business of promoting values, at least not in promoting any values that are specifically Greek. Second, though the divine pantheon is essentially the same, for Zeus, read Jupiter, for Hera, read Juno, etc., Virgil's gods are very different from Homer's gods. Homer's gods, particularly the gods of the Iliad, acknowledge at times the pointlessness of involving themselves in human affairs. In the Aeneid, by contrast, the gods are utterly determined in the pursuit of their personal goals and far more formidable in consequence. The exception is Jupiter, who has a cosmic plan for the foundation of Rome. In the Iliad, as Zeus promises to assist the Trojans in order to give honour to Achilles, in other words, to make the Greeks realise that they're useless without him. We're told that it's a plan, but in actual fact, he's repaying a debt to Achilles' mother, Thetis. In addition, several other gods, including Hera, Athena, Poseidon and Apollo, have a personal animus against Troy. In the Aeneid, by contrast, Jupiter's plan, which is to settle the Trojan refugees in Italy, has implications not only for Aeneas, but also for all future generations, or at least for that vast part of the human race that will come under Roman rule. In other words, Jupiter comes close to orchestrating human destiny. As he says early in the poem, to the Romans, I set no limit in either time or place. I have given them an empire that has no end. Third, the Aeneid exhibits a profound sense of historical perspective. Though it's set at a precise moment in time, it constantly extends its arc beyond the present moment into the future, or rather into the Roman readers. Present. This comes out particularly strongly in Book 6, when Aeneas descends to the underworld and encounters his father Anchises, now dead, who reveals to him the future course of Roman history. He describes the seven kings, the establishment of the Republic, and the Augustan Principate that followed. What makes this episode extremely poignant is that Aeneas can hardly understand any of this except in the most general terms. So it means next to nothing to him, though he realised that he is an important part of it in some vague way. The most poignant moment of all is when Anchises points out to him a young man called Marcellus, actually Augustus's nephew, and then says, "Tu Marcellus eris." You will be Marcellus. But Marcellus was already dead when Virgil was writing. He'd been adopted by Augustus in 25 BC and had died just 2 years later, aged 19. He'd been regarded as a possible successor to Augustus, and his death made a profound impact on the Roman people as well as the imperial family. So we see the past, which is to say the time of the action of the poem, looking at Rome's future, which is already, to the reader, its past. By contrast, both the Iliad and the Odyssey hardly ever look outside the legendary present in which they are set, other than in instancing the fate of Aeneas, who, according to Poseidon in the Iliad, will survive the war to rule the Trojans, the prophecy, of course, that is adopted by the Romans. Fourth, the Aeneid is infused with a pervasive sense of melancholy. Aeneas himself is defined, one might almost say, by loss. In the course of the poem, he loses his wife, his father, and his mistress, Dido. Dido, in fact, commits suicide when he abandons her to follow his destiny and never forgives him when she meets him in Hades. Loss is the price Aeneas must pay for being marked out as the instrument of Jupiter's plan. And it's also the price, Virgil seems to be saying, that the Roman people must pay for being the world's sole superpower. Aeneas will live only 3 years after the final episode in the poem, so he won't see the foundations of Rome's greatness laid. There's much sadness in Homer too, the grief of Achilles, for instance, at the death of his dear friend Patroclus does not colour the entire poem, as does Aeneas' sadness. First, because Patroclus dies two-thirds of the way through, and second, because Achilles' response is as much one of anger as it is of grief. And in the Odyssey, Odysseus is reunited with Penelope at the end of the Odyssey. Fifth, there's the extraordinary ending, when Aeneas, the personification of piety and of obedience to duty, kills his enemy Turnus on the battlefield in a sudden spasm of rage, just as Turnus is pleading for his life. He does so because he sees Turnus wearing a sword belt that he stripped from a young Trojan who was very dear to Aeneas when he killed him. The incident is clearly reminiscent of Achilles' refusal to show any mercy to Hector, the killer of his friend Patroclus, when Hector begs him to accept a ransom for the return of his dead body to his parents. But there's a profound difference. The Iliad ends, or nearly ends, on a note of redemption. Achilles and Priam, the king of Troy, weep together when Priam comes to beg for the return of his son's body. Achilles' anger, in other words, has, by the poem's conclusion, dissipated itself. The Aeneid, by contrast, ends with Aeneas' thoroughly uncharacteristic outburst of anger. Most educated Romans would have picked up on the Homeric references and reworkings because they would have been familiar with Homer's verse. And some Romans, at least, thought that Virgil had beaten Homer at his own game. The elegist Propertius, for instance, wrote, "Something greater than the Iliad is being born." And we see from this remark that the Romans were deeply conscious of the fact that they were placing themselves inside a tradition begun by the Greeks, similar to what Aeneas did earlier. Virgil himself, however, was profoundly deferential. "It's easier to rob Hercules of his bow than Homer of his verses," he is said to have memorably observed. Epic poetry didn't come to a grinding halt after Virgil. Ovid, who was a generation younger and a poet of a very different stamp, used it for the Metamorphoses. Metamorphoses is a Greek word meaning transformations. The transformations in question are the shape-shiftings that occur in mythology. Gods assuming the shape of humans, beasts and rivers, humans being transformed into animals, trees and stars, and so on. The poem begins with the creation of the human race, and it ends with recent history, the transformation of Julius Caesar into a god. Somewhat ironic, maybe. It's a patchwork of more than 200 tales taken mainly from Greek myth. In fact, Ovid is one of the principal literary sources for our knowledge of Greek mythology. Lucan wrote an epic poem in the reign of the Emperor Nero entitled On the Civil War, the war in question being the civil war between Pompey and Caesar that took place in the early 40s BC. The atmosphere of Lucan's poem is worlds removed from that of the Aeneid, however, although it's heavily dependent upon that poem in a number of ways, including scenes that Lucan took over and reworked, and also in its emphasis upon the pathos of war. But whereas Virgil's poem celebrates Rome's refoundation under Augustus, Lucan deals with what he perceives to be the loss of liberty resulting from the demise of the Roman Republic, which became particularly acute under the Emperor Nero. In fact, his poem has been described as an anti-Aeneid because of the negativity and pessimism that pervades it. And there are no gods overseeing the action. Lucan was forced to commit suicide by Nero, accused of being involved in a plot against his life. But he'd lost favour long before that, perhaps because his poem was seen as a personal attack on Nero, even though it contains a panegyric to the emperor. And conceivably, too, he was regarded by Nero as an artistic rival. Well, whatever Nero's true motive for eliminating Lucan, later poets stuck to safer subjects. Caelius Italicus, AD 26 to 102, wrote an epic on the Second Punic War entitled Punica, in which the gods play again a major role, In it, Hannibal becomes the instrument of Juno's wrath. A generation later, Statius, who grew up in Neapolis, a very Greek city, as we've seen, wrote an epic called the Thebaeus. It deals with the war for succession to the throne of Thebes, which broke out between the sons of Oedipus on their father's death. Its themes, however, were universal civil war and intrafamilial madness. And they were also part of the political landscape of the day, I might add, albeit the poem was clothed in the legendary past. The last epic poet to write in Latin was actually a Greek called Claudian, born in Alexandria around AD 370, who moved to Rome in 394. Claudian wrote an epic entitled the Gildonic Revolt. It deals with an unsuccessful revolt in 397, contemporary therefore, led by a former Roman officer called Gildo, who sought to establish a breakaway kingdom in North Africa. And the last epic poet to write in Greek was Nonnus, who lived a full century later than Claudian, and who wrote a work called the Dionysiaca, which dealt with the opposition to the establishment of the cult of Dionysus. Interestingly, he also wrote an epic poem based on the Gospel of St. John, which shows that epic, later in its life, was serving a Christian agenda. So, epic had a pretty good run for its money, at least 1,200 years in antiquity. To conclude, nothing is more remarkable in the history of Latin literature than the extraordinary flowering of the epic genre, a genre that is cumbersome, portentous, and cluttered with all manner of literary devices. The Romans might well have taken a look at it and decided to give it a wide berth, but they didn't. They embraced it and made it their own. In consequence, nothing in the field of Latin literature demonstrates better the Roman genius for refashioning an existing model. And the fact, too, that the epic genre was of equal importance to both the Greeks and the Romans is a measure of how the two cultures, in formal terms at least, thought alike. In the next lecture, we're going to look at drama, with which the Romans had a much more complicated relationship.